Local governments are weighing raising fees or cutting services to make up for the potential loss of revenue as Florida lawmakers consider eliminating or reducing property taxes, a change that would impact homeowners and renters. That revenue pays for public safety, parks, schools, and other services people rely on every day. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, April 16th, 2026. Coming up on Engage, we'll look at efforts in Brevard County to slow down the development of massive data centers. And we'll meet a pair of Central Florida filmmakers behind a heartwarming comedy about family, religion, and growing up. But first, the revenue collected from property taxes is one of the primary sources of money for local governments to pay for police, infrastructure repairs, parks, schools, and other services. One of the most recent proposals would go the furthest in that it's seeking to put a constitutional amendment on the 2028 ballot that would eliminate all property taxes. To help us understand exactly what that would mean, here's Esteban Santis with the nonpartisan Florida Policy Institute.
If you're looking at the proposal to eliminate all property taxes, now we're talking about all of those local jurisdictions, your schools, cities, counties, and special districts. They would no longer collect the property tax. And this would not be only for those primary residences. I think if you look at the proposal for all, that would also include commercial property.
At this point, there's no final plan from lawmakers, and Governor Ron DeSantis has not set a timeline for a special session on this issue. But the idea that has moved the furthest so far in the legislature is a proposal passed by the House of Representatives that would end non-school property taxes on primary homes.
If you have a primary residence in the state of Florida, so that means that you've applied and received what we call a homestead exemption, you would qualify or be eligible to essentially not pay property taxes to your county, your municipalities, so your city, and also any special district that you are under the jurisdiction of. The House's proposal says, okay, schools aside, everyone else will no longer collect property taxes on those primary residences.
That House bill includes provisions to protect funding for public safety services like law enforcement. While the House passed the legislation, the Senate did not take it up, and members of that GOP-led legislative body have said it doesn't go far enough. Any final plan from the full legislature and governor would have to be put on the ballot and approved by 60% of voters. Local governments are already thinking about the potential impact. T. Michael Stavris is a city manager for Winter Haven and talks about what's at stake if property taxes are reduced or eliminated.
When we look at the concept of emergency services, so police, fire, and code compliance, those are the three legs of the stool of public safety for us. Combined, those are about $34 million. So all of the property tax that comes in total is short of what it actually costs to keep a community safe. And that's even before you start talking about what's the cost associated with maintaining your parks and recreation as safe places, or improving and maintaining your roadway network and your sidewalks. So I think that that's probably the biggest aha moment for folks when we talk about property tax.
So some proposals being floated would either reduce or eliminate certain property taxes. If that happened, what services do you think would be most impacted?
There's not an agreed upon proposal as of yet. There was a couple proposals that came about as bills. What finally came out of the House was a proposal to completely eliminate the homesteaded property tax, or the property tax on homesteaded properties, specific to everything except for your schools. Under that scenario, Winter Haven, of that $31.5 million, we would lose about $10.5 million. So who does that impact? It's kind of interesting because one of the caveats that was found within virtually all the proposals, and certainly the last one, was that you wouldn't be able to reduce your services in law enforcement. So you have to look at everything else that you're funding there to see, okay, well, what don't we do? Do we not maintain our parks at the same level that we do? Maybe instead of mowing and maintaining your parks every week, you're doing that every 4 weeks, every 3 weeks, your frequency of resurfacing roadways, your mill and fill projects to improve your asphalt could be reduced in how much you're able to invest there. If you have general fund contributions that go to, say, your library operations, if you have less money to put towards libraries, maybe that reduces the number of hours that a library operates. Those are the types of things where I think the impact certainly is felt the most. But that's not to say that every department and every service is not impacted in some way. As an example, if I have less funds, less opportunity to provide safe recreational spaces and recreation programs for youth, I think the data clearly shows that children who are not active in positive, productive activities like that are more inclined to find trouble and end up within our juvenile system. That puts a tremendous strain on our law enforcement side. The other piece that I think is kind of an unintended or unanticipated outcome, if we're a state that does not have an ad valorem tax on homesteaded properties, our attractiveness for new residents increases exponentially. The increase in population, I think, accelerates very quickly. That puts strains on all of our systems and puts additional strains on the services that we need to put in play to respond to that.
How do you maintain that expectation of quality of life with increased stress? Is there a proposal that's better than another?
The challenge that we have is we're trying to anticipate the impact of a proposed tax reform without actually knowing what that looks like. So we're talking about how do you maintain a level of service that you're providing today with fewer financial resources to do so? That's very challenging. So we're still kind of in the dark a little bit. I think the best that we can do today is to really educate and be fully transparent with all of our citizens across the state of how local government functions financially, encourage their involvement to come to budget meetings and ask the questions and get the information as to how your tax dollars are actually being used, what it costs to provide services. Where do you receive services today that you don't pay for through another means other than property taxes? One of my approaches in talking with citizens is if you ever had to call the fire department to come to your home and extinguish a fire or to your business, and they come out and they do that, when it's all said and done, they don't take that iPad out and show you, okay, this is what it costs for the staff, and this is what it costs for the truck and the fuel, and here's how much water we put down, and here's your final cost for our services today. And, oh, there's a little, you know, option here if you want to leave a tip. Or if you were going to a park when you got there, there's not a turnstile or a ticket booth that says if you want to get on the swing set or the playground, here's what it's going to cost you today. That's part of the education of it, is really understanding those things that we see every day, that beautiful landscape or that well-maintained road, the officers that are on patrol or the fire department that shows up to an accident. You're not paying for those every time you avail yourself to the service.
Could you take me behind the scenes a little bit of those plans and conversations you're having, preparing for the possibility of changes in property taxes? Are there specific services you're looking at?
Yeah. What are the core things that we have to get done? What are the things that are tied to life safety, to health? It's the other things that make a community special. In our case, we have a grant and aid program. It's a competitive program that helps provide financial resources to the nonprofits that serve our community in those areas that we don't, in food ministry and certain social services and job skill development, those types of programs, your Boys and Girls Clubs, your Meals on Wheels programs, things like that. Those then fall outside of that core service, and those are probably the first things you look at. Your support for economic development and for chambers of commerce and those types of things, your special events that you offer throughout your community. You start looking at what has the least impact on the overall safety. And so I think the things that suffer the most are the quality of life things that make us an attractive place for people to want to live.
That was Winter Haven City Manager T. Michael Stavers. Some cities are already planning for the possibility of losing money from property taxes. In Longwood, commissioners held a work session last week to talk about the budget, funding options, and strategies like fee hikes. Financial Services Director Dustin Woolbright answered questions from councilors about possible increases.
Our parks fees and some of the rental programs that Leisure Services have. Again, I want to caution that, you know, our city is a very, very strong destination for events.
And we want to press out of the market.
Right, we don't want to press them out of the market, but we are evaluating all of those fees.
Longwood's Director of Leisure Services, Chris Capizzi, at the same meeting spoke to commissioners about areas where increases could be possible.
things such as pavilions, ball field rentals, community building, possibly the amphitheater. The amphitheater is kind of unique, but again, every dollar counts. Services such as those can be increased. We have probably one of the most affordable summer camps in the entire county. Those are things that we don't want to have an exponential increase on. However, we could probably go up $10, a kid, something like that next year.
Property taxes are the largest source of revenue for Longwood, making up 48% of its general fund, according to this year's budget. If the revenue goes away, local governments will have to make it up somehow. Esteban Santis with the Florida Policy Institute says the impact would not be evenly distributed.
So who would benefit the most if you eliminate property taxes for those primary residences? One, because it doesn't have any income restrictions, you're going to have wealthy property owners who may not be struggling as much as individuals who are making low to moderate income. They're going to benefit. In terms of who else would benefit, people who can afford to outsource or pay for services if there is a cost shift. I would say those are some of the clear winners, but I think there are more losers though, who would lose local governments because now they're going to have to balance their budget without a key revenue source. Individuals in the community who are now going to have to pay higher fees or have lower quality public services because of the repercussions of having less resources at the local level for those local governments. I'm trying to answer the question fairly here, but really, if we go back to just the idea that this is a cost shift, this isn't really an answer to affordability. It's just a different way for Floridians to pick up the tab. I say that carefully because it really comes down to how you're going to make up the revenue. But let's say we don't make up the revenue and we just cut services. That's going to impact all of the community, even individuals who didn't get a tax benefit because they didn't own their home. That's something else that we're not really acknowledging in the conversation. Renters, individuals who don't have their home, which is, I think, over 30% of the population. What are they getting in return from this? Now they're going to get lower quality public services or they're going to have to pay more for them.
Esteban Santis is director of research at Florida Policy Institute. He also wrote an analysis of a recent study from FPI that finds some of the state's largest counties, including Orange, would lose the most revenue from the property tax reform measures considered during legislative session. We reached out to officials in Orange County. The director of the Office of Management and Budget says they are monitoring legislative discussions, and they can't do long-term planning without knowing more specifics of what is being considered. They did add the House-passed proposal would impact Orange by $541 million, according to estimates from the Florida Association of Counties, and that would require significant cuts should it move forward. For residents, the impact varies based on their circumstances. We asked you to weigh in on reducing or eliminating property taxes.
Hello, my name is May. I'm a homeowner in Orlando, Florida. This talkback relates to the question of property taxes. While I greatly appreciate the goal of making housing more affordable, I don't think cutting property taxes is the way to do it. History has shown that cutting property taxes only shifts the cost burden onto renters and low-income folks who are still forced to pay sales tax and who are also still dealing with an affordability crisis. If we want to make housing more affordable, we have to return to economic-first principles and address the housing shortage. We do that through government regulation and subsidies, not by engineering sugar rushes that only cut funding to crucial community services like fire departments and libraries, of which I might add, we have very few of compared to most other developed nations in the world. We know how to fix this, and cutting property taxes is not the solution.
Let's hear from Kenneth Mundy, who owns a primary residence and a rental property in Central Florida.
I own both a primary residence and rental property in Central Florida and support retaining property taxes. Property taxes are used to fund local services and infrastructure, and the cost year on year is predictable with a set annual percentage relative to property value and is not a big cost concern for people like me. Homeowner property insurance, on the other hand, has unpredictable premiums that can increase without restriction. For my rental properties, the increases have been between 35 and 90% per year, and every year they impose costly requirements to renew. It benefits only shareholders and the profit margins of property insurance companies that act without much regulation in Florida relative to other states. The proposal to do away with property taxes shifts benefits to the largest property owners, including major corporations that are owned by hedge funds and other investment companies. While it would result in a minor cost savings for people like me, My ongoing concern isn't property tax, but property insurance. This property tax bill deflects attention from the failure of insurance reform in Florida and our current governor, and the continued unchecked profiteering by insurance companies. It also disproportionately benefits the wealthiest property owners, while hurting the budgets of municipalities that provide benefits to the average citizen.
Thank you, Kenneth and May, for taking the time to weigh in. Supporters of cutting property taxes say homeowners are paying too much. While speaking at Palm Beach Atlantic University at the end of March, Governor Ron DeSantis talked about rising property values and higher tax revenues driving the push for change.
Well, listen to these numbers. This is why we need to do it. In 2019, local governments in Florida, for all the services, all property tax revenue, $32 billion was going into the coffers for all the things they do. Today, that number is $60 billion. Now, we've had inflation, we've had population growth. Heck, throw in 3 or 4% increase just for the heck of it, you do not get to $60 billion. You'd get to $45 billion with that. So the question is, how are they getting this money? They're valuing the property higher. Some are raising millage, but they're valuing the property higher. And so you have a gusher of revenue, and instead of returning that money to taxpayers, they're basically spending it. The administrations are getting bigger.
The governor also talked about phasing out taxes on homesteaded homes over time and the idea of grants to help local governments with the transition. DeSantis said he wanted to get through the legislative budget process and then get something done before the November election.
There's obviously a strategy involved. We also have to work through the House and Senate. And look, I mean, personally, I think a lot of these guys don't really want to do anything on it, or some of them, maybe I should say. But here's the thing. I don't think you can be a Republican and not put something on the ballot and then face voters this year. Of all the things people come up to me about, this is 90% of what they come up to me about, because they understand how significant it would be for them and their family to be actually be able to own your home and not just be paying rent to the government, not be kicked out of your home or have the government take it because you can't afford the property tax after you've been paying it for 30 years.
Supporters of changing the tax system say there are different ways to limit how quickly property taxes grow. Doug Wheeler with the James Madison Institute, a conservative-leaning think tank in Florida, discusses those approaches and the results of their most recent polling, asking 1,200 Floridians about property tax reform.
When you look at the group that wants moderate reforms, and it's significant at 42%, what we're getting from them is that they are sensitive to the fact that significant cuts could potentially impact services they value, of course. Now, everybody values different services at different levels and different values, but nonetheless, I think people are sensitive to the fact that there are some core services, and certainly education first and foremost, and then certainly followed closely by police and fire. And I think you're even seeing that reflected in some of these proposals put forth by the House of Representatives.
More than half indicated they would like to see property taxes tied to economic indicators like inflation and population growth. Can you tell me more about that? How would that even work?
It's essentially a levy cap, and it's not really a new concept. There are varieties of it around the country, but generally speaking, the levy cap, it's really just trying to assure that a local government does not grow faster than the citizens' ability to pay for it. Essentially, what it says is that it's going to tie growth, ad valorem collection growth, revenue growth, to match the growth of the community. If their community is growing, there's a metric of measuring a community that involves population growth, cost of living increased, or inflation. And putting that together would basically give you your growth metric. What we like about this is that it does tend to force the hand of bringing in some of these collections under a little bit more control. Some of the growth we've seen has been well beyond the growth of these communities.
What was most surprising to you about the results of the poll?
I think most disappointing is that maybe only half the people are familiar with a levy cap. And so I think that probably points to the fact that we probably have some work to do relative to putting this forth as a proposal.
Doug Wheeler is a director of the Gibbs Center for Economic Prosperity at the James Madison Institute. As the proposals are debated, Central Floridians will weigh the impact that could be felt here. I want to share an email we received from Lisa in Titusville. She writes, "While all of us would appreciate lower taxes, it is unrealistic to assume it would be a good development. Without property taxes, the necessary services we all rely upon will not be properly funded. So the result would be what? If all these services are privatized, the communities with resources will be able to afford them. Those communities with lower income residents will suffer." Thank you, Lisa. We appreciate you and everyone who takes the time to share their perspectives. You can help shape the conversation by sending an email to engage@cfpublic.org or recording and sending us a talkback on the Central Florida Public Media app. There's more ahead on Engage. Artificial intelligence is booming, but a Central Florida county isn't buying in. Why they're turning down tax breaks for AI infrastructure. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on this program, the film Ethan Bloom tells the story of a 13-year-old South Floridian facing a religious crisis while navigating life following the loss of his mother. Director Herschel Faber and writer Mylon Dominguez talk about growing up in Central Florida and how it influenced their film. But first, last week, the Brevard County Commission voted to ban any property tax abatements or exemptions for data center developers to build new centers in the coastal county. The vote was unanimous. A few members of the community vocalized their objections to the development of these massive tech centers, including Rick Heffelfinger of Brevard County's District 1.
I've seen the YouTube videos. I've seen all the stuff about, you know, the data center goes in. There's high-frequency hums. They're getting zoning to put them next to houses. They're destroying people's lives. And then you find out, well, hey, they got this power requirement, right? Well, your power plant's not big enough. You better build a bigger one for us. You don't have enough water. You better put in some water. And these people are seeing rate increases because the more demand, the higher they can get, right? So they're seeing their utility bills go crazy only because these guys moved in and started sucking up all the resources.
To simplify it, data centers are storage facilities that hold and process much of the data that powers the internet, from websites and personal data to shared media content and even the information used by smart appliances from your phone to your fridge. As AI applications grow, so does demand for storage and computing power. The centers are popping up in a number of states that are demonstrating a business-friendly environment for the industry. But in some communities, residents are raising concerns about the centers using essential resources like water for cooling and regional power supplies. There are also concerns that demand could drive up energy costs in those communities. Some residents complain the facilities generate a loud hum, creating a persistent noise permeating nearby homes. We spoke with Brevard County Commissioner Katie Delaney, who brought this ordinance to eliminate data center tax incentives to the table.
It was brought to my attention that when we updated our ordinance for our tax abatements, that data centers were going to get a 20-year tax abatement. And that was really concerning for me. And over the past year and a half, there have been so many community concerns as far as data centers went, not just in our community, but across the country. And so I was like, we need to take care of this before we're in a situation where we're giving one of these data centers 20 years tax abatement.
Can you share some of those concerns that you were talking about that you were hearing from the community?
People are concerned, especially about the water usage. We are already experiencing a shortage of potable water in some of our communities, especially the north end of North Brevard. So that was very concerning for me because that's where all of the available land is, North Brevard and the very south end of Brevard. And so if one of these data centers were to come, it's likely they would either try to come to the north or to the very south. So I knew that at some point we'd definitely run into that. Another concern that I heard was people say that there is like a hum that comes from these data centers all the time. And it really messes with people's quality of life. So, you know, that was also another concern. Another one that I had read an article about was they're starting to see that the land that data centers are on are increasing in temperature. So the worst one that I saw was 16 degrees difference since the data center was put in place. And so that's also concerning. We don't know what that will do to the environment and whatnot around it. So that was concerning. And then the final thing was jobs. You know, this is a industry that comes in and it doesn't really bring a whole lot of benefit to the community. And it doesn't even create that many jobs. So there are some that have as little as 5 employees once the data center is built. And so this is an industry that takes a lot of resources, takes up a lot of space, and doesn't provide jobs. And so I'm not really seeing what the positive is for having one of these in our community.
It does seem like growth of these centers is somewhat inevitable. And we are seeing some power companies restructure rates so residents don't have to shoulder the increases brought on by those high demands of the high-scale data centers. Are there measures you'd like to see that would make you more comfortable with this increased development?
I truly believe that they should pay their way. They should get some kind of additional fee because they can say all day long, oh, you know, we're paying our bill, so that should be enough. But when they're putting such a strain on the power industry, the water industry, and we need to update our grid and our water plants and things like that, that's more than just normal usage. That's over and above. If we're having to build new plants and expand the grid, that's far different than normal usage, in my opinion.
Katie Delaney represents District 1 in the Brevard County Commission. Some residents of Brevard County have been voicing their opposition to the development of AI data centers in their communities. Stelle Bailey is a lifelong Brevard County resident who grew up on the Space Coast watching rocket launches from her backyard. Her grandparents are even buried in Brevard County. As the executive director of Fight for Zero, a nonprofit organization focused on preserving the environmental health of Central Florida's East Coast, she doesn't see how data centers could contribute to preserving the region's environment.
We're seeing it across the country where people are talking about these data centers and the impacts that they're having close up to communities, whether it's the humming noise levels or exploiting their resources, such as water resources, depleting water resources. So I think that's why we're having concern here on Florida's Space Coast is because we already have water quality issues and we already have infrastructure issues that are very severe. And so to bring in a data center to our area that doesn't even bring in long-term job opportunities is problematic for us. It's like a parasite to the community is how we view it. We're on the Space Coast where we have the highest level of technology. And so I think we should be able to pick and choose who our industries are.
Are there other hidden costs to you of these data centers?
The hidden cost for me is the depletion of resources. That is the biggest hidden cost for me is we're already seeing wells dry up in our county. And so how do they plan to come in? And our space industry uses our potable water for their launches. And so if we continue to add, we have this piecemeal approach that we have here. And I'm sure you see it across the country as well, where, you know, they permit this amount of water over here, amount of water here, here, and here, and they treat each individual thing like a data center, like this industry, as individual numbers when there's an accumulative impact there. And so as far as the data centers go, I think the biggest thing is the exploitation of our resources. And unless they can do something better, we're always about building a bridge over to these industries, but they've got to find a better way, whether that's reuse of water and not depleting our water sources.
What are you hearing from other members of the community about these centers?
I think they're very concerned. Some people don't believe that there's even a possibility that they'll come here. But we've been hearing murmurs of lobbyists already trying to get into the ears of our politicians here locally saying, well, we've got some clients that are very interested in certain locations. And one of those locations is something known as the Palm Bay Compound. It's a development that never came to fruition. There's a lot of property out there and it is ripe for something like this. And I think at the end of the day, what's the most important is transparency to a community. So if they are going to bring a data center, I think where you see these communities uprising is because it feels like they're doing it behind closed doors. And what they really need to start doing is bringing it to the forefront and being able to have that conversation and that connection with the communities before it ever becomes an outrage and they feel like they're trying to do a backroom deal.
Are you surprised that there was unanimous support from Brevard County commissioners?
Yes, I'm not surprised from my commissioner personally, because she's been really good about representing the people as a whole and trying to get ahead of these things. I was just really surprised that it was a unanimous vote, that they all agreed. So what that tells me is that they're paying attention, they're hearing what's going on, and they're trying to not be reactive, but proactive with this situation. The one thing that we are known for in the state of Florida, especially in my area, is tourism and our water quality. And it hurts us deeply when that's impacted, from our fisheries to our other natural resources to our tourism industry. And so my hope is that if there is a data center that is considering coming here, that they would bring the community to the table and to have a larger conversation and maybe work together.
Stell Bailey is the executive director of Fight for Zero in Brevard County. On the other side of the coin is the data industry. There are roughly 4,000 data centers currently operating in the United States, a doubling of the number since 2020. There are 3,000 more data center projects in development. Right now, there are roughly 125 in operation in Florida. Dan DiOrio is the Vice President of State Policy for the Data Center Coalition, a nonprofit industry association for data center developers and operators. DiOrio contends data centers do create plenty of long-term jobs and that the public is misinformed about their environmental and energy impacts.
And construction jobs, building data centers, what we have seen is then turn into much more longer-term opportunities. We see crews get contracted to go from site to site for a specific company. We see crews to go from building to building on a campus, turning into much more longer-term positions than what certain individuals would think of previously. But data centers create strong business ecosystems around them. There's this perception that there's no jobs in a data center, and it couldn't be further from the truth. Data centers are actively investing in workforce development pipelines so they can have the right amount of technicians and engineers to work in their facility. These facilities need to run at an optimal level at all times. They need technicians there to monitor the performance of the facility and ensure that their customers that they're serving have access to their data in a timely fashion. They require local electricians, local plumbers, local HVAC technicians to be working on their facility, and they partner with them significantly. For every one job in a data center, six jobs are supported elsewhere in the economy. You have manufacturing, things like chilling equipment, mechanical components, electrical components. You have steel fabrication. You have service industries. There are significant job opportunities created by data centers. So these are very much economic development opportunities in communities, and they bring strong economic benefits to those communities.
So understanding that tax abatements and exemptions are a routine part of brokering development, do you feel communities get an appropriate return on these tax breaks for data centers?
Yes. Data centers create significant amounts of local revenue. We know in a place like Loudoun County, Virginia, for example, Virginia is the largest market in the world, and Loudoun County is very much at the center of that. For every $1 in local services that the data center utilizes, it gives $26 back in revenue. Data centers are about 3% of the total land area in the county, yet nearly 40% of the general operating revenue that the county receives. The county has reduced taxes 2 years in a row, attributable directly to data center revenue.
What are your concerns when you hear of a local entity like the Brevard County Commission unanimously voting to ban any data center tax incentives?
I think what that says is that that community is closed for business. And I think it very much sends a signal of unpredictability and uncertainty that will ultimately harm that community's ability to attract economic development from data centers. But I think it sends a signal to the broader community and business community as well, as far as how that community will view economic development opportunities.
An issue that we heard from some people in the Brevard County community and critics in general involves the amount of power and water that these centers require. Why should local communities accept the environmental and infrastructure impacts.
Data centers are amongst the most efficient water users in the economy. Data centers use less water than manufacturing. Data centers use less water than food and beverage production. Data centers use less water than what's lost to water leaks in municipal water systems on an annual basis. In the world's largest market, Virginia, 83% of data centers use as much, if not less, water than a large commercial office building, and data center water use is sustainable. This is an industry that continues to push the bounds of water efficiency and continues to emphasize using resources wisely for its own sustainability and water positivity goals. So the industry will continue to be amongst the most efficient water users, and the contextual evidence is important for understanding how data centers use water as compared to other industries. So I think the narrative that data centers are excessive water users is false. I mean, the evidence very clearly shows that this is an industry, when you look across industrial users of water, is actually using water very efficiently, using proven technologies to improve water efficiency at their facilities.
Dan DiOrio is the Vice President of State Policy with the Data Center Coalition. While Brevard County is sending a clear signal that data centers could face an uphill battle in establishing in that community, a different approach is brewing 120 miles to the southwest. On Tuesday night, the Fort Meade City Commission in the small town of just over 5,000 residents voted unanimously to allow developers to begin a $2.6 billion data center project in western Polk County. Stonebridge, the development company behind the project, says a 2 million square foot data center could use 50,000 gallons of water a day once operational. Stonebridge said construction will begin as soon as possible. One Winter Haven resident was quoted as saying, "This is going to destroy us." Coming up, Keeping the Faith, the creators of a new film exploring love, loss, and religion, join us next and share how their Central Florida roots shape the story premiering on screens this week. You're listening to Engage. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. In the film Ethan Bloom, the title character is a 13-year-old boy growing up in Miami, experiencing an existential crisis of religious proportions. Ethan's mother died a few years earlier, and as a Jewish preteen approaches his bar mitzvah, he finds the questions he has about life are being answered by a Catholic priest that he befriends, much to the consternation of his father.
Don't get mad.
Me? I'm a teddy bear.
I passed out feminist manifestos.
Okay. I'm not going to say that was the most socially apt move you could make, but it was honorable.
I used the Virgin Mary to make my point.
More Catholic shit?
This is why I don't tell you things.
Hey, wait. Wait, okay. Look, I'm trying. Judaism is very important to me, to our family. It was important to your mother. Never mind, it's just I have this new rabbi coming over today to start tutoring you for your bar mitzvah.
What the hell?
Look, I did make you go to Hebrew school. I felt that was a fair trade.
No, this is out of the question. I'm not having a bar mitzvah.
This isn't up for debate. We're already behind the eight ball on this. This rabbi will be able to get you up to speed quickly.
You are not listening to me. I'm not having a bar mitzvah.
It's not optional. For God's sake, you're named after my grandfather who died in the Holocaust. This is who we are. Let me be very clear. I will forbid you from going to the church.
Dad, that's the only thing I have. Please, no one understands me. Please.
All right, pal. But we have to find a compromise here.
The film touches on a number of issues that teens deal with. Guns, drugs, sex, loss, and the confusion that accompanies the search for answers. It's a genuine and heartwarming story written into the setting of South Florida by screenwriter Mylon Dominguez, an Orlando native who converted from Catholicism to Judaism
after meeting her husband. Ethan Bloom was directed by Herschel Faber, who grew up Jewish on the Central Florida coast. The film has been screened selectively throughout Florida. Tomorrow, it will open in Winter Park, New Smyrna Beach, and in the Villages. Dominguez and Faber sat down in studio with engaged producer Richard Copeland to talk about the film. Dominguez starts the conversation by describing what the title character is looking for in the film.
He really is trying to figure out the thing that I think we're all trying to figure out, which is something that you can't actually get from the outside. It's something that you have to find it within yourself. And, you know, ultimately, yes, his connection to his mother is what he's seeking. And all of these other characters are really like different representations of his mother, whether it's, you know, the Virgin Mary, whether it's a priest, whether it's a rabbi, whether it's the girlfriend, whether it's a teacher, whatever it is. But I think that ultimately what he has to do is he has to come to the point where he accepts the messiness of himself and the complexity of who he is, and that it's not going to be something that's easily defined or boxed in. And so in many ways, I feel like that's the search that we're all doing. We're all trying to figure out how is it that we in our own kind of complex, messy ways fit into this world that sometimes really tries to pin us down and put us in a box.
And therein lies the brilliance of the writing, because we're seeing that perspective. We all experience that through our entire lives, but we're seeing it through a very pure, unadulterated view of this 13-year-old boy who's experiencing all these things for the first time. So he's kind of working from a blank canvas.
I love that perspective, because there's this idea in Zen called the beginner's mind, which is that whatever it is that you're experiencing in a moment-to-moment way, if you can come into it kind of without your baggage, you can actually experience life in this really expansive, miraculous way, kind of with a curiosity and thrill of being alive. And I think that Ethan is a representation of that spirit, which is, first of all, kids tend to have that anyway, but usually by Ethan's age, you know, by 12, 13, adolescence, you've lost that. And I don't know if it's because of the fact that he's experienced grief young or because he's just an introspective kid. I think it's a combination of both, that we're able to maintain a more eloquent, verbatious character who's able to still express that fresh spirit that we see in young children, sometimes in toddlers when they first start speaking, or really young kids. And I think it's that sweet essence that we have inside of us.
Yeah, and to add on to that, it's not easy for kids these days. And I think one of the reasons audiences really connect with Ethan is because he's an unusual teenager or preteen. And kids these days are bombarded by their phones, their iPhones, by computers, computer games, all kinds of, you know, really terrible images that they're encountering on, you know, in Hollywood and things like that. And so I think what makes Ethan a refreshing character is that you don't see him really engaging that much with his phone in this film. He's very tuned into the present and the world around him and aware of things in a way that most kids aren't.
Were you able to connect experiences as a youth to some of the difficulties that Ethan had?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that drew me to the script, and Mylene will get into her background as well. For me, I grew up in New Smyrna Beach, and we were the only Jewish family in town. So that was isolating to begin with. All of my friends were celebrating Christmas and, you know, Easter while Hanukkah and Passover were happening. My mom converted from, she was Lutheran. So I did have that half of my family, but she converted from Lutheranism to Judaism. And I was raised very Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed and confirmed, but I had to drive 45 minutes to the nearest temple in Ormond Beach. So I always felt a little bit like an outsider, having grown up in that environment and isolated and kind of lonely at times, particularly during holidays, because I was the only one celebrating Hanukkah. My friends weren't really coming over to do that, but I was going to their house to, you know, open a gift they might have gotten me for Christmas or something like that. So yeah, experientially, I had a lot in common with Ethan growing up, for sure.
That's such an interesting point to hear Herschel speak on that, because I'm half Puerto Rican, half Cuban, and I grew up in Orlando at a time where there were very few Latino people. There are, obviously, there's a wonderful community of Latino people in Orlando now, but when I was growing up, there weren't many. My father was a doctor, and the connection that my parents made, so our close friends, were all Latin American Jews. So I grew up, like, the only other Latino people were like Chilean, Peruvian Jews. That's who we grew around. So I got really exposed to Jewish culture at a young age in a way that I loved, because I was like, it was, you know, it's very similar to Latino culture in that it's very family focused, food focused and all of that. But I got to experience as a child Shabbat, and I thought it was the coolest thing I had ever seen, to have a father kind of like say a prayer to their child at the dinner table. I thought that was beautiful. And my mom sent me to the JCC in Maitland as a kid. And so I have funny stories about that. When she sent me to the JCC with a ham and cheese sandwich, and the director of the JCC was like, excuse me, you know, Mrs. Dominguez, you can't have a ham and cheese sandwich at the JCC. And then the next day she sent me to the JCC with a ham sandwich, and the director had to say, no, ham's not going to work either. So, you know, we had a learning curve, and, you know, my sister and I wanted to do Shabbat Friday nights. And then, of course, ironically, or maybe not ironically, we both married Jewish men, and I ended up converting.
We were switched at birth.
Talk about the reception. It's a funny, though thought-provoking film, but it also contains some elements that could chafe some people.
Well, I will tell you, we just opened at the Movies of Del Rey and Movies of Lake Worth. And, you know, it's a very Jewish community that's seeing the film here. And the response has been through the roof crazy. And during the Q&As, Mylin will speak to this as well, but people were sharing their emotions, and they connected with it on a level that I don't think that, you know, a lot of films lately have been able to sort of conjure up in their audiences. And people just have had this visceral sort of reaction and relate to the quest for faith. They're looking for something that's positive in their lives, because the world is in such disorder and chaos right now. And you don't leave the theater feeling doom and gloom. You feel like there's hope. And everyone kind of keys in on the idea that this is a movie about love as much as anything else, and the idea that we are all from the same tribe and love transcends everything. And it's been, for me, particularly gratifying as a director to be in an audience and see someone laugh or cry, have an emotional response to the film. But I think there have been two people that I've encountered since we've opened, and they had an issue with some of the things that we spoke about with religion. They felt like maybe I cracked one too many a joke, but it's not very common. And, you know, any artist, when you put yourself out there, you're gonna get people who don't love what you do. But I think the greater part of the community, I would say 99.9%, are loving the movie, and that's exciting.
And just to add to that, you know, I've had people who are devout Christians and Catholics come up to me as well and say how much they connected to the film. And I think at the end of the day, if you are of the belief that what you believe in is the only thing there is to believe, and you want to watch things that tell you that what you believe is the exactly right thing to believe, then maybe you might have an issue with this movie. Because what this movie is much more expansive than that. This movie is more saying, you know what? Whatever you believe, we hear you. You're like, we're there. You know, we're only looking at Judaism and Catholicism because, you know, you can't go through everything. But it's much more open-minded. It's saying, you know what? You're a little bit of both. Life is messy. Things are complicated. It's more of that feeling, which I think is very resonant with the vast majority of people.
What do you hope people take away from this movie?
I hope that they will leave with their heart open. I feel like they will be excited to have reflected back some of the humanity that exists out there. There's so many good people always doing amazing things. You know, I walk through this world and I see people, strangers, doing such kind and beautiful things. And what we see reflected back to us is not that. What we see reflected back to us is always all of the terrible things that are happening in the world and all of the terrible things that are happening. And I feel happy to be able to represent something that I think is really beautiful and a really good reminder for us. And then the other one, which is something that Herschel and I bond on, we're both parents. And, you know, it's so hard to tell your kid how much you love them. And this movie, in the way that it represents some of the feelings that it's showcasing to our children, like, we love you so much. We might not be able to say it in exactly the right way, but if you see this, know that these are our words too.
Beautifully said. And I'm going to even simplify it more for me, because I had a really cool experience actually coming to the station today. I was getting ready to turn in onto the street here, and there was a car in front of me, and there was a bumper sticker on the back that just said, I hope something really great happens to you today. And it's a small thing, and we see these things, but I just was moved by it for some reason. And I was like, I hope that when people see the film, that they feel like something great happened to them. They had this experience, and it's, you know, allows them to possibly see the world in a new way. you know?
Ethan Bloom opens tomorrow night at the Regal Windsor Park, the AMC 12 in New Smyrna Beach, and the Old Mill Playhouse in The Villages. We'll have links and information on our website at cfpublic.org. That's all for this week's edition of Engage. I want to invite you to our event tonight, Engage in the Community Redistricting. Voting maps are usually redrawn every 10 years, but Florida leaders say now is the time to redraw them. Some question whether changing the maps mid-decade is fair or even legal. Join us for a community conversation tonight, Thursday, April 16th, at the Osceola Council on Aging. Hear from experts, share your voice, and see how district lines shape your community. The panel discussion starts at 7 p.m., and we hope to see you there. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.